So, you think they'll get together again?
I think it's definitely possible.
Yeah, me too. It's so interesting to hear stories like that about two people with so much power over each other.
Temptation, right? You do what you want even when you know it's bad for you.
Yeah, temptation. What is it? Why are we so powerless against it?
It's almost a different part of you, a part that doesn't care about the consequences.
Or enjoys the consequences?
I don't know, maybe. How do we get on to this anyway? Weren't we talking about Nemesis?
Right, but now I want to take us a little bit deeper into it, because I think there's one famous Nemesis we haven't talked about yet. Aren't you going to guess?
I don't know. Liza Minnelli?
Liza Minnelli?
Never mind.
Liza? No. I'm talking about Satan.
Oh, Satan? But he's not real.
Says you. But according to a 2007 Reuters poll, about 62% of Americans feel otherwise.
Oh, and he's every one of their nemesis?
In a certain sense, yeah. But not like the old days. I'm talking about early modern period old days.
Oh. Wait, when was that again?
About 1500 to 1800 AD, roughly. The devil's heyday, when people actually expected to meet him on their front porch. I might be wrong, but I'd say that's not quite so common anymore.
Yeah, I've been offering my soul for a new hard drive for about 6 months now. Where's Satan when you need him?
He's still here. He just gets called something different now. But I'm getting ahead of myself. For now, let's meet this early modern period devil.
I'm scared.
It's okay. We have a witch expert with us.
I'm Laura Stokes. I'm an assistant professor in the history department here. I'm working now on finishing up a book called The Demons of Urban Reform, which is on witchcraft trials in the 15th and early 16th centuries.
Her specialty, witchcraft trials during the 15th and 16th centuries, is perfect for our purposes here. Perfect because the 15th and 16th centuries are right about the time when the devil goes from being a kind of vague abstraction to a very real, very physical figure with a presence and a body. Someone who is actually very much like a human.
Well, the fascinating thing is that the devil is really just an ordinary guy. And so in the trial documents I'm looking at, most of them come from 15th century Switzerland, and they come from a time when the witch, in the sense that we tend to imagine her, was just coming together in a new sense. And I'll tell you a story about one of the trial documents that really struck me, a woman named Dilga, who tells the story of, and you have to understand she was being tortured and questioned at this point, but she tells the story of her first encounter with the devil, and she says, "It happened about 15 or 20 years ago. Her husband had recently died. Her sister, Ursula, had been drowned as a criminal. She had four small children. Her in-laws wouldn't help her. She thought she was going to starve. She was really just right at the edge of things. And this man came to her, and he said, 'Dilga, why are you so despairing?' She'd been thinking about killing herself. He said, 'Why do you do this to yourself?' And she said, 'Well, I don't know what else to do. I'm completely at my wit's end. I don't even know how to feed my children.' And the devil, well, we didn't know he was a devil yet. But the man said, 'Well, if you'll just depend on me, I'll take care of you, I'll take care of your children, everything will be all right.' Dilga asked him who he was. And he said, 'I'm the devil. And my name is Frank.'"
Okay, so we've got Frank, the devil, and he's meeting single women and seducing them into witchcraft. But really, that was just one of his many nefarious functions. For most people, the devil was the cause of temptation. All temptation, the ultimate explanation for why people did wrong. And that made him a fearsome force you had to constantly be on your guard against.
So let's say you're a 16th century carpenter, right? You would probably believe that the devil was the cause of you suddenly stopping thinking about carpentry and thinking instead about your neighbor's wife. No matter how fine she is, the fact that your thoughts have suddenly slipped track is a sign that the devil has kind of subtly deluded you, or tempted you, and you've fallen, you failed, because you did think about your neighbor's wife in ways you ought not, and so forth. There's a personal responsibility in that. It's not as if the devil has done it, therefore it's not my fault. If the devil made you do it, you're also guilty because you let the devil make you do it. You would also believe that the devil was omnipresent in trying to harm you, making you sick, making you afraid, causing your business to fail. And that kind of personal adversarial relationship with the devil could be quite strong.
All right, so we're on our way to my second point here, but I want to emphasize what Laura is saying about the personal nature of the relationship with the devil. This was something that literally everyone struggled with. That 16th century carpenter is a stand-in for any good Christian in Switzerland or Germany or England or any Christian country. And what's also interesting to point out is that this devil is new. This devil does not exist in the Old Testament, nor does he exist for almost a millennia and a half of Christianity. So the question is then, where does this devil come from? And the answer is simple. John. Milton, that is.
My name is Martin Evans, and I teach, I've taught at Stanford for 44 years. I teach Renaissance literature and the literature of John Milton in particular.
Martin Evans is a Milton scholar, and the reason we're talking to him is that Milton, more than anyone else, crystallized the Western conception of the devil with Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained. By the way, just to give a time period for this, Milton's writing in the mid-17th century. Okay, here's Martin again.
What he's done is to synthesize two major strands in the history of the devil. His name, Satan, to begin with, simply means adversary. And in the Old Testament, you will find absolutely no real trace of the idea that he is a devil. In the book of Job, he seems to function like a kind of celestial district attorney, seeking out and prosecuting crime or weakness. Now, the devil that Milton is describing here in book two, who has fought a cosmic war against God, is a product of another completely different tradition. And it all goes back to a verse in Isaiah chapter 14, which goes like this. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart...
The passage in Isaiah is one of the few biblical passages making reference to Satan's origin. And the reason it's important is that it gave crucial ammo to Christian theologians in the early years of Christianity in the first few centuries AD. Christianity, a monotheistic religion, was opposed in its early existence by dualistic sects, who claimed the existence of evil could be explained by two gods, one good and one evil. In the character of the devil, Christians found a counter-explanation for the existence of evil. There was only one God, and he was good. All evil came from the devil.
They're all ways of explaining the existence of human wickedness, and perhaps equally, the existence of natural and physical evil in the world, to explain things like suffering, human suffering, disease, earthquakes, floods, storms, all these things that cause human beings suffering and pain.
Because God can't be responsible.
Exactly. A good God, a benign God, a benevolent God, the kind of God that Christianity has believed in for over 2,000 years, couldn't possibly be held responsible for that aspect of reality.
So evil can exist and God can still be good. And over time, because a concrete figure that you can see and smell and who can whisper things in your ear was more convincing than an abstract force, the devil began to take on a shape and a presence. But still, he wasn't quite that human-like, terrifyingly tangible force that Milton describes. To get to Milton's Satan, we need to go back about three centuries to Dante in his Inferno. And to get there, we need to talk to an English professor.
My name is Roland Green. I'm a professor of English and comparative literature. One of the interesting developments in how people understood the devil over the course of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance is the way that he or it evolves from Dante's time to Milton's, becoming in the process a kind of full-fledged character.
So the devil that existed in Dante's time, the 13th century, wasn't much more than a concept. People cared about what the devil did, but no one really cared who he was.
Well, I think for a very long time, they continued to think about evil as obviously a moral problem and kind of a value in the world, but it really does not fully get reimagined in a way that modern people would understand until Milton.
Milton, when he comes along three centuries later, reimagines the devil as something with a shape and a mind and a personality.
So the character that Milton inherits from the Christian tradition has these two very different aspects. He is Satan, And as Satan, he's crafty, cunning. He's a typical tempter, which is part of his function. As Lucifer, he is charismatic. He's valiant. He's brave. He's a hero.
And Milton writes about this devil so well that he basically destroys any of his contemporaries' hopes of creating an equally memorable devil. Milton's endures and becomes the devil that exists for many people. This devil, that has become the embodiment of evil by the late 17th century, is part man and part monster. He's a charmer and a tempter. He knows your weaknesses and he speaks your language.
Part of the danger of Satan is that he can blend in. He can speak to you in a voice that seems to be... This is what Milton is picking up on and giving the fullest possible expression to. The idea is already out there, but Milton turns it into... He sees the dramatic potential in it. And the idea is that Satan is dangerous precisely because he can speak to you in a voice that sounds like your own thoughts. He can, and they are your own thoughts because everybody has a little of evil inside them. He manages to speak to you on a frequency that you will find to be natural and attractive and magnetic.
Okay, there's something really crucial to my point in what Roland was saying. Remember that point I was going to make?
I remember you told me that you had a point.
Good memory. Well, first I just want to show that the devil is a worthwhile study in the study of Nemesis, and I think I've shown that, no?
I suppose.
Thank you. But in case I still haven't, to anyone out there, I'll have someone smart say it outright.
Well, the devil is obviously the great nemesis of Christianity, but he's also the personal nemesis of individuals.
But something that Roland says helps get me to my next point. Here, I'll spotlight it.
And the idea is that Satan is dangerous precisely because he can speak to you in a voice that sounds like your own thoughts, 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 that sounds like your own thoughts.
A voice that sounds like your own thoughts.
Right. My point is this. Maybe he is your own thoughts.
I'm not sure I buy it yet.
Okay. Well, what is temptation? And you're not going to tell me that temptation is just a Christian concept.
No, I wouldn't.
Right. Well, what is temptation but a voice in your head? And for Christians in the middle of this millennia, all those temptations were actually cataloged and ascribed to different devils.
There's a whole genre of something called devil's books that appear within Lutheran culture, for example, where all the sins of humanity are ascribed to particular devils who are imagined. The money devil, for example, who's the devil that tempts us to greed and avarice and to being miserly, to being ungenerous with our neighbors. That's the money devil, you know. Then there's the drink devil, who's one of my favorites, who tempts us to get really drunk and to beat our wives and do other bad things that we ought not do, to completely lose all control, to not be temperate. That's the drink devil. And there's a whole series of these devil books. And of course, scholars can say, well, this is just an allegorical use of the devil and so forth. But it's quite clear that people like Martin Luther really believed in the devil. And they really confronted the devil in a personal way.
Okay, now zip forward a few hundred years, and that whole library of devil's books, that whole system of explaining the existence of evil, is replaced by a different kind of book, a different way of looking at desire and other unwanted thoughts. You see where I'm going with this?
This is getting very interesting.
The patient is very astute. Thanks, Dan. 300 years after the devil loses his grip on the Western psyche, another bearded fellow comes along to give us a different explanation, or a not-so-different one. Around the beginning of the 20th century, a psychotherapist from Vienna named Sigmund Freud posits an unseen force that dictates our every action. He doesn't call it the devil, though. He calls it the unconscious.
The unconscious. I don't do that.
Did your unconscious just make you do that?
Kind of a little bit.
And this explanation is extremely convincing for a lot of people, but not for everyone. Laura, unsurprisingly, falls into the first category, the secular devil doesn't exist camp. So I asked her if, in her research, it was hard to put herself in the minds of people who really believed in the devil.
Well, for me, it's quite easy. I grew up in a fairly fundamentalist religious background in which that devil is quite real even today. So although my religious distance from the devil is much greater now than it was when I was a child, I have no difficulty at all, because there is a continuity within, particularly within that subset of Christian culture today, there is the continuity of the reality of the devil and the physical experience of the devil. Even the appearance of the devil in visual forms to particular individuals.
Laura told me a story, actually, that perfectly showed these two different conceptions of evil in action.
I was once on a Greyhound bus in the middle of the night in Tennessee, and I was talking to the fellow next to me, and I told him I was a graduate student and I was taking a break from doing research in Switzerland on witches. And he became very interested. His interest was piqued up at that moment. He said, So, which side are you on? And I said, What do you mean, which side am I on? He says, well, are you on the side of the witches, or are you on the side of the Christians? And I said, well, I don't have anything against the Christians, but in this case, I'm on the side of the witches, because they were innocent, at least in my very sort of explicitly realist atheist perspective. And this young man said to me, well, the reason I ask is because I'm a warrior of God. And he believed, genuinely believed, and he was a really wonderfully friendly, loving young man, as far as my encounter with him was in this, you know, one night in the bus in the middle of Tennessee. He said that his purpose was to combat the devil in the world, not metaphorically, but really. And he believed and he experienced that the world was full of demons, and that they were the source of our multiple temptations and our failings and our fallings and our difficulties. And that in order to fight them, you had to have basically a legion of warriors of God who were combating this diabolic threat. And so to him, thinking of the witches of the early modern period, it made perfect sense that they were, in fact, allies of the devil.
I don't know. It sounds like the devil is sort of a completely different force. You can't declare war on all those inner urges, you know, lying, cheating, eating the last piece of chocolate cake or whatever.
Right. Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. But I actually think this whole battle image functions better as a metaphor, even in the Demon Hunter's case. And Laura agrees with me.
Well, I battle my demons by thinking carefully about the motivations of my actions and their origins and so forth. And to me, the word demon at that point is merely a metaphorical reference to my failings, my persistent failings as a person. So, yes, in that sense. But actually, in talking to people who do have a very strong belief in the actual presence of demons, that their way of battling their demons is very similar. They look at their own motives. They ask themselves, you know, why am I doing this? Am I doing this for base reasons? And if so, how do I keep myself from doing that? And part of their practice is different from mine. Part of their practice is prayer, right? And trying to clothe themselves in righteousness and trying to combat the devil in that sense. But part of their practice is very similar to mine, which is to question their motives and to try to push themselves towards a path where they're going to act in the way that they believe they ought.
So there you go. The devil starts out as an abstraction, spends a few centuries imprisoned in a hell no one can see, ventures out to charm some witches and tempt us into coveting our neighbor's wives, and then ends up right back in that private hell again. Our imaginations, our thoughts, our minds.
That's deep and dark.
Thanks, Dan. I'll take that as a compliment.